Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Mr. Bliss, good morning.
Good morning, John. How are you?
I apologize for bombarding you, but I found that L.A. Times piece compelling, and given that it says everything you've said for years. Good
yep.
God. Now, they did a nice piece of reporting picking up on that 61-year-old who got mugged on. You recognize that street, something like South Broadway? I don't know where.
Well, of course. It's one of the main streets in downtown L.A., government and business buildings, yeah, and you know, my brother-in-law and his wife had a business down in that area, and while they sold their business for different reasons, the dealing with the homelessness issues was a daily occurrence, and sometimes hourly. They had a significant business in the downtown area.
I thought I'd open with Click's story, and then we'll go to the statistics.
Okay.
It's funny that they think Mayor Bass is in trouble because of it. I mean, you know, the vote in the mayor's race. You've got one person to vote for, and Cynthia,
Nithya Raman.
Nithya is homeless. She's the homeless chief on the city council. Way to go, Nithya.
Yeah, Nithya the stalking horse. That's all she is.
It's funny. All right, here we go. We'll start with the homeless story, and then we'll go to Vegas and get, you know, like life of the party. And
all right.
When we come back, we'll do the politics of the moment, which is, everybody, it's all Newsom. There's no rival. It's foolishness. It's all Newsom.
You saw the polls I sent you, right?
Yes, thank you. Here we go. Here comes Roman music. Good morning to you. Thanks, Jeff.
Good morning.
Good day. This is the making of the John Batchelor Show on a beautiful New England summer's day. Modest temperatures, modest humidity. The fires of Canada have momentarily shifted away from this atmosphere. No rain in sight. The lilies are in bloom, glorious lilies. The hydrangea coming in. In other words, it's a good day to be in the United States of America, unless you're in downtown Los Angeles. I read from terrific reporting by the LA Times. Mr. Click, C-L-I-K, a business owner in downtown Los Angeles. The 61-year-old was sitting near his gift shop in downtown Los Angeles this month when two men threatened to kill him if he didn't give up the gold chain hanging from his neck. They grabbed the chain and disappeared down South Broadway. It took 45 minutes for the police to arrive, said Mr. Click. He doubts they will ever catch the criminals or recover his chain. This is what downtown is now. Who would want to come here? There's more reporting on Mr. Click because it's a very sad story and the LA Times is compelling about this story. Mr. Click says he opened the garage-sized store in 2001. Offering a wide variety of goods, including snacks, suitcases, sunglasses, stuffed toys to tourists, office workers, and area residents. He has witnessed the once bustling corner of town turn into a shell of its former self, strained by rampant crime, rising costs, stiff competition from safer neighborhoods. He is scared every time he opens up the shop, a afraid that any incoming customer could rob him. He suffered from panic attacks since the incident. I put that story first because I welcome Jeff Bliss, his Pacific Watch, and we have a number of new statistics on homelessness and despair and failure in downtown Los Angeles. But I didn't want to begin with numbers. I wanted to put it into action, and the LA Times did a terrific job of seeing the world from Mr. Glick's point of view. Really, we don't need politicians to solve this. We need just common sense. You don't have to be the mayor of the town to know what needs to be done. You have to provide Mr. Glick security, and that means you have to do something very, very obvious about homelessness. Jeff, a very good evening to you. I do not want to preach, but this story, you immediately understand his point of view, and you puzzle how L.A., one of the richest cities in the solar system, has come to this. And I understand it's the Hemingway joke, right? Slowly at first, and then all of a sudden. Okay, but here we are. Last week, you noted that there were stats coming on homelessness. What do they look like, Jeff? And I'm presuming they're negative. Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. It's not good news for the city and the mayor, you know, anybody else who cares about these poor people in L.A. The numbers are going up, and nobody thought that there wasn't a belief that they were going to stay where they were. And there's been a thought for years that the city and the county underreport these numbers when it's convenient and overreport them when they need some money. But this is what Spencer Pratt and others who are running against Karen Bass and the race to try to change things have been saying, is that it's not getting better. Despite the piecemeal programs that the mayor and others offer, it doesn't really help. And, you know, we do see some numbers go down occasionally in homelessness. A lot of that is attributable to fentanyl and other problems that are happening on the street. But all one has to do is drive through L.A., you know, in this area near Mr. Glick, of course, and see the encampments. And you think, how does a city like the one you described, John, a powerhouse city, a major metro city, how does it let this happen? How does it let it continue to grow and fester? And again, this has nothing to do with the people. We're not talking about the people who are in these encampments. You know, they're there because of drugs, alcohol, mental illness, a combination of all those things, economic problems. But there are people that are benefiting from this. And we've talked about this now for close to two decades, John, the homeless industrial complex, that, you know, people in these NGOs and other groups that get fat off of these problems. And so the more these grow, the more they need these NGOs, the more they get paid by the city, county, state, it goes on and on. So there's a reason why the numbers grow. It's because not only allowed to grow, but it's profitable for certain politicians and developers and NGOs for it to grow.
The genius of William and Goldman writing for Hollywood. Follow the money. We're going to begin, Jeff, because I want to begin with the top down, Inside SAFE, the mayor's signature homelessness program, which has some alarming facts about what happens once you house a homeless person in L.A. And then we'll turn to the big numbers about what this means for L.A. now, especially the politics of the mayor's race. And I want to be upbeat about L.A. I don't want to just beat it up right here. There are a lot of people who want this to be solved. So we'll look to the Olympics. We'll mention Boylton?
What? Boyle Heights.
Boyle Heights, which I read this morning, has a vermin problem along with everything else. Good heavens.
Yeah. And the odor problem is driving people out of town. It's getting worse. And of course, with our heat wave that we've had, it's just cooking it. You can smell it from miles and miles away.
And we have the unfinished business of the Pacific Palisades. Then my favorite remark from Jeff Bliss's Pacific Watch this week. No, I'm not repeating myself when he sent me there was a water break in West Hollywood. That's because they were fixing the line. It put pressure on another weak point. I mean,
yeah, some of these infrastructure points, some of these water mains are over 100 years old. and they're on a schedule to have been fixed years ago. And some of them, they're still not going to get to them for 10 years.
I would say we have a problem with water in L.A., but given, you know, get in line. Here we go, Jeff. Thank you.
That's what Chinatown was about, right?
Yeah, we'll fix it. 5, 4, just not this century. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome my good friend and colleague of many years, decades, Jeff Bliss's Pacific Watch. There are some numbers from the L.A. Times about homelessness in California that deserve attention. I mention right away, however, Mayor Karen Bass, who has been very keen to address homelessness in her first term, now running for a second term, has a program Inside Safe. That is her signature homeless program, which, according to stats published by the LA Times, has moved more than 6,000 people into hotels, motels, and other types of interim housing since the mayor took office in December of 2022. However, I read on. But by May 31st, 41% of those people had returned to homelessness, according to figures collected separately from this year's homeless count. Under LA's mayor's $300 million homeless program, 40% have returned to the street. Jeff, this is pretty much like bailing out a boat that has a leak in the bottom. You keep bailing and you're not making progress. 40% are back on the streets. I have to believe it's not because they wanted a home. It's because they're chemically dependent and their health is broken and they have camaraderie on the streets. These are human beings. They go where they're gregarious. They want to be with people like them, and isolated in a hotel or a motel with rules and supervision is not how you want to spend your days. However, the mayor is running for re-election. There is a homeless lobby, and I believe that homeless lobby also is in contact with the other candidate who is a member of the city council and who is in charge of homelessness for the city council. Are these politicians challenged, Jeff, about these numbers? Or, you know, it appears you don't have a choice in L.A. You either vote for a homeless campaign that doesn't work, or you vote for a homeless campaign that doesn't work. That's your choice. Good day to you, Jeff.
Good day, John. First, let me say nobody is surprised that the numbers are showing an upward trend. Like I said before, all you have to do is drive through the city and the county. You know, it's about 88 cities in the county, and you see that change. Even when you go through wealthy parts of LA County, the people are somewhat more transient there. They don't stop, but you do notice the uptick in the number of people who are pushing their carts through or trying to sleep at a bus stop or any of those types of things. This is a problem in LA that is just overwhelming. The city has changed in ways that it's almost hard to describe. And, you know, I grew up in Southern California, in LA County. It seems like every week, several times a week. And I notice it. And you just see these, you know, what was, you know, a group of people here or a person there has now turned into these encampments. Sometimes they're actually set up in lots. Other times they're these, you know, it's a parked caravan of RVs and old broken down campers. They set up these little towns, and these have just grown bigger and bigger. I mean, I think I sent you some information this past week that, you know, it was only about a decade or so ago that Skid Row in the downtown area comprised 5 blocks. And even back then, people were saying, wow, that's a lot. Now it's over 50 blocks and continues to grow every year by I think, 5 more blocks or so. So this is the problem we're looking at. It's not just encampments. It's a city within a city. It's this dystopian thing that's hard to describe. But when you see it, you are shocked. You think, this is the United States? How could this be?
Some numbers, although they're numbing, but some numbers. Homelessness in L.A. rose 3.4% citywide year over year, and 7.9% among people living outdoors or in their vehicles, sources familiar with the numbers said. What is that, living outdoors or in their vehicles? Those are the parked vans that will never move. Is that what they're talking about, Jeff?
Primarily, yeah. You drive down some of these streets and you just see, you know, RV after RV after RV, and they're in terrible shape. You know that they were just towed there. They don't drive. They never have. And they're rented out by essentially cartels to the homeless. And so a lot of these vehicles aren't their vehicles. They're just tooting around town in. These are these encampments that are set up, like I said, by organized crime for the most part, and they become places of prostitution, drug manufacture, drug selling, and they rent these spaces to these people who are homeless. You know, they get their monthly checks, their stipends from the government, and boom, they go to pay for the housing, they go to pay for drugs, they go to pay for food. It's a pretty sad situation.
The mayor's race. City Council member Nithya Raman, this is the LA Times reporting, who oversees the council's homelessness committee and is running against Baz, called the citywide results disappointing but not surprising. This is LA Times, while saying that her own district saw significant decreases. The quote, leadership at City Hall has not shown the willingness to shift toward an approach that actually moves people into permanent housing, and these results make clear that the mayor's approach is not working well enough. Jeff, what is her district? I thought that, is that one of the well-to-do parts of town?
She's in a very nice part of town. She has a beautiful home, of course, and you know, her husband's a TV producer type, so they're doing quite well. And was very upset when people brought homeless there to, you know, as a demonstration. But yeah, she, you know, I mean, every area of LA is impacted. So I'm not going to say they don't have experience homeless people in their area, but it's certainly not like downtown, like what we've been talking about this morning.
And what is the response from the city's residents? This is the mayor's race. It's about the future. It would appear that both candidates have a lot of explaining to do about their first term or their terms in office. Raman, who is homelessness specialist on the city council, which is a power base, and the mayor in City Hall, are they... I have to believe they're not held accountable, despite the LA Times' indication they are.
Yeah, they really aren't. It's amazing. And what's been interesting is after we had the primary and they emerged as the two top vote getters, very little has been said about it. Now, Karen Bass has shown up at a couple photo ops. This is something that she's done throughout her first term, where she introduces a new hotel that they've taken over. It's, you know, going to be 10 or 20 or 30 rooms, and she says, hey, we're on our way to fixing homelessness. And as you pointed out, it ends up being 50% or less, you know, occupied. And really, you know, it's always good to make any dent they can, but they're not making a dent, because as they bring these things online, to bring these homes and apartments that are barely occupied, we're seeing the growth of homelessness in the area, because LA makes it very convenient and very profitable for people to be homeless and for people to be in the homelessness business.
South Broadway, do I have it right? That's a major thoroughfare in downtown LA. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
South Broadway. There is a story here. It's lengthy, but it comes to this. A man named Mr. Click, talking to the LA Times, has a novelty store on South Broadway. He's had it since 2001. Sitting on his front stoop, one day, recently, two men approached and said, we'll kill you if you don't give us the gold chain you're wearing. He does, of course. They run away. The report is it took 45 minutes for the police to respond, and Mr. Click says, I live with anxiety attacks ever since. Every time somebody walks into the store, I think I'm going to be robbed. He goes on to say this, what used to be bustling, meaning the early part of this century, and is now vacant. You could see the empty storefronts. Jeff, this isn't just about homelessness. It's about the failure of the city to prosper in the central district where it used to prosper. So it's not just the damaged lives that you're witnessing on the streets. It's damage to your finances and to your ability of the city to grow. That must be compelling to more than just the homelessness industrial complex. That's got to touch everybody who does work, who works in L.A. or L.A. County.
Yeah, it does touch everybody. And, you know, there's a growing feeling among people that that LA, the core of LA, is hopeless, that they're giving up on it, that that it is past entering the death spiral and is well into it. And you see that, as you point out, the number of businesses that have left, the number of businesses that are not eager to start start a new thing there. It's just not, it's not a thing. I mean, LA has become kind of a no-go zone for a lot of people. And, you know, you mentioned this man in the story who is dealing with crime on his level. I can tell you from my own family's experience, I have a brother-in-law and his wife who had a very good business in the downtown LA area, showroom and a manufacturing facility. And this was a constant battle. They've since sold their business and moved elsewhere, not because of homelessness, but it was a constant battle, not just daily, sometimes hourly. People using the front of their store or other parts of their building for toilets, sleeping in the doorways, all kinds of things. And, you know, people didn't want to come there to do business because it seemed dangerous and threatening. And he found people in their store sometimes during a weekend when it was shut down, or, they'd come early in the morning to open things up at 6 a.m, say, and there were already homeless people who had broken into the basement storage facility part of the building. So you hear these stories again and again and again, and it's, you know, Mayor Bass can brag that she's opened another 6 rooms to 12 people or something in L.A., but in the meantime, 200 or more people have been scared off that same day.
Before we go to the good news, and we have to go to Las Vegas for it, a second water main break, why?
Yeah, they're investigating that. It appears to be part of the bigger problem, the aging infrastructure in LA's greater, water district there. But it wasn't very far from the one they had last week that unleashed millions and millions of gallons and destroyed, you know, millions and millions of dollars worth of property in that area. It's still being repaired. These parts of the infrastructure, these water mains and other pipes, some of them are well over 100 years old. And were scheduled to be fixed a long time ago, but still are on this list where that was like, maybe we'll see it in 5 or 10 years. This is a growing problem in LA. I talked to an infrastructure expert about this earlier in the week. He said this is a problem actually in a lot of the big cities he deals with. He's within an industry in the infrastructure environment. And he said this is a problem that's just all over the place. The cities, the counties, the states are running out of money, and now we're starting to see the cascade of failure.
Good news next. Jeff Bliss is Pacific Watch. High Roller Bliss is about to give us new information about Las Vegas. I'm John Batchelor. The baseball team and the athletics is coming to town. Not yet. It's playing, I believe, in Sacramento this summer. However, there's exciting news about it because already there's a minority investor who's, I believe this is the man who's very well known, Mr. Mark Cuban. Jeff, a very good evening to you again, because I want to do good news about Las Vegas. It has to be exciting to anticipate the athletics, but I hadn't considered it from an investment point of view. This is very good that Mark Cuban is in, because that'll raise the profile. He was wonderful for a basketball team. He might still own it. I don't remember. But you need energy to promote a team at the ownership level. And I haven't asked about the ownership of the athletics. Is it a vigorous ownership? Because all those years in Oakland, it looked like it was drifting.
John, I would say, the Fishers and others who have ownership in the Oakland A's and now the Sacramento A's, I think it was vigorous in the sense that they had the money and they had a vision, but it wasn't for Oakland. So when money wasn't being spent in Oakland, of course, you'd ask the people up there and they say, no, they don't have the energy. But it looks like they've been saving it all up for this Vegas venture. And having Mark Cuban on is a great sign, because not only does he raise the profile and probably attract more money to it, but he's a very savvy investor himself. And so it's very likely that what he's doing right now speaks so well of the franchise, because he says, here, I recognize a future for this place. And I agree. I think this is a big step for Major League Baseball. It's going to benefit the sport and the league. And it's really going to benefit Vegas. But I think the club, after establishing itself there will have a run in a few years. I really do.
Jeff and I enjoy playing SimCity with Las Vegas. It's great fun. Okay, we're going to add another. There was a failed Ferris wheel. This is news to me. And a 12-acre site, and it's now been purchased from the investor class that owned it. And they're going to build a heart-shaped hotel. Is that what it is?
Well, it supposedly features a big glowing heart in the middle of it as part of the structure, the overall structure. There's been some debate as to whether this is, you know, really going to happen or not, just an attempt to get some attention. But there is a large space there that it was supposed to be, as you pointed out, a massive Ferris wheel, kind of like the Eye in London. But Vegas already had a Ferris wheel. They've got their wheel down near the link, and I've been on it. It's beautiful, especially at sunset. But this was never developed. The two pillars still stand there today after years and years. And they've been talking about, what are they going to do with this property? Well, it's all down that end near the baseball field. That whole area is going to be developed. It'll be, even if it doesn't have the heart on the front of the hotel, it could be a pretty marvelous looking resort.
So this is close to where the baseball is going to be. That would make it convenient. The hotel would do business for baseball.
Relatively speaking, yeah. Well, any hotel down that area, probably any hotel in Vegas, is going to do business. How many will they draw night after night? It's hard to say, but it gives another option. So, it also makes the capacity for conventions and conferences and other big events even greater. And I'm sure people like Formula One are looking and thinking, that means we can bring even more people to Vegas.
Jeff, final detail here, just a few moments' attention to what we know to be true about Hollywood, creative destruction. Disney and through Pixar are laying off people. Is that because Pixar is in trouble or just a natural evolution of Hollywood?
I think it's a natural evolution of Hollywood. It's probably, creative destruction of capitalism. It's the shareholders demanding more. There's a lot of anger right now. There always is with these things in Hollywood because Toy Story, Pixar, their Toy Story 5 it looked like it's crossing the $1 billion mark. So people are thinking, great, we worked all these years and now we're out of a job. But that's the way L.A. has been. You know, one of the stories this morning about L.A., we were talking about what's been happening with homelessness and other issues, is the number of bookings for location shoots in L.A. is down over 13%. And that's very telling. That shows that the film companies are not coming back like they thought they would. And that's another big ding and the Nithya Raman and Karen Bass platforms.
Jeff Bliss is Pacific Watch. I'm John Batchelor. Okay, I think we touched everything I wanted to. We didn't get to Mr. Newsom, but he'll wait. He's ready.
Well, I'll tell you, the news coming out about that investigation into him and his wife is getting kind of wild because what was revealed yesterday is that a person inside the Newsom camp was being monitored by the federal government with wiretap for over 2 years. And the way they put it was had a wire on them, but it wasn't really, they weren't wearing a wire. They had a tap on everything they were doing. And it appears that person is Jennifer Newsom. And what's really interesting is, to get these wiretaps, you have to go back every 30 days to a judge, show them what you've already got, and tell them what you think you're going to get the next time. So these federal judges, and this was happening during the Biden years, kept approving it, approving it, approving it. There is not just smoke there. There's something bigger.
Well, what? I'm lost in the plot here. That, if I understand correctly, Ms. Newsom is a filmmaker. An educational filmmaker. And she was hired by or a part of the establishment that sold to California schools and others.
Right.
So what is the big picture that they're investigating then?
Well, the big picture is who they were getting money from, how they were getting it. In other words, how they were pressuring it and how they would use it. And so, there's these connections with, for example, the public utilities, the ones that cause all the wildfires, that that they give a great deal of money not only to Newsom's campaign, but we're giving these payments to her foundation, or her filmmaking. And so that, you know, if there's something there that, you know, they were talking about on their phones or online, or directly, they have witnesses to corroborate it. That's what they're looking at, is and that money and those, they call them sometimes the ones to Newsom's efforts, they call behested payments, but they're really just bribes.
All right, but that's, you know, you could argue about this for a long time. Who's driving such an investigation? It occurs to me that, in other words, at worst, you could say that she was used as a cutout to get the governor's attention. That is pretty commonplace. So who has it in for the Newsoms in the Democratic Party? This was the Biden years, right?
Well, yeah, it was DOJ. But now that you've got the Trump folks, hey, this is meat. This is red meat, you know.
I see.
But and it's not just the campaign; it's that the contention is that they made themselves wealthy with these monies, them personally wealthy, and you know everything from their growing bank accounts to their multi-million-dollar home in Marin County. There's a whole list of things people point to.
Yes, but it occurs to me that the Trumps have set a new standard for corruption. If you're not in the B billions, you're small ball. But however, there's more to learn about the Newsoms, certainly. They remain a very viable candidates for 28. And you've seen the polling, Jeff. My goodness. My Republican brethren, good heavens. 11-point generic gap at this close into the midterm?
Yeah.
How do you recruit with this thing? Why would anybody want to give up his or her life to run for Congress for the Republicans when you're facing having to raise money in the face of a generic gap of 11 points? I don't remember it ever being that big, but I don't remember 94 when Gingrich flipped the Congress so big. Do you remember what the generic gap was? This is more than
I don't remember what the gap was, but it was it wasn't. It seems like this is bigger, but also, you know, it's interesting to see how much financial trouble it seems the DNC is in right now.
Oh, I've missed that story. Are they shy of funds?
Yeah. Matter of fact, they had a meeting this week, and everybody that attended it had to sign the NDA, including people that work in the office, and they said it was pretty grim.
That's odd, isn't it?
Yeah, they've been trending this way for a couple years, you know, in terms of what's in their treasury. So, but you know, I don't know how much that matters when you have somebody like Newsom who has the Gettys and the Pelosi money and all that behind him, and of course the other people in that group who seem to have a lot of money, the Democratic group.
Maybe they don't, if you have the Congress, you don't really need that much money. Good heavens.
But there was a lot of talk this week about how far Gavin had slid down in those polls. Now, it might mean nothing when we get to November or, you know, the next campaign. But they were surprised to see how far he had dropped.
Oh, one more detail before we move on. The 40-foot wave, what happened? Where is it?
No, it's out there mushing around in the Pacific. By the way, you've grown it again. So I never said 40 feet.
I can't remember. I didn't mean to exaggerate.
You said 30, and that's really, people I think would look at me out of the side of their eye even at 30. But I was like, okay. But no, I went down there yesterday morning. I dropped my wife off at the airport, which is right down near the beach. And it was nothing to write home about. I just hung out for a few minutes and came home. That happens. Sometimes you get a big storm in the south, and it doesn't turn out to be as big when it gets to the beach. But there's another storm brewing. I think this is going to be a chain of things we see with El Nino.
Oh, El Nino news everywhere. I saw an article in Science Magazine. This, from the point of view of people who watch the ENSO, that's what we're watching. ENSO is the acronym, and that's El Nino. This has the potential of being the biggest thing they've tracked ever, because the Pacific is very warm. The waters off of L.A. are very warm, and that creates the conditions for El Nino. The droughts and the flooding and the droughts and the flooding back and forth. And I believe for Southern California, you're due for a drought. I believe that, but I have to check it because they're moving the story all the time.
Yeah.
I'm reading why it is that I've come to this part of my life where I have time to read about. I don't know what it means, Jeff. I think it could have other significance that worries me. Am I getting ready for eternity here, reading about El Nino?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the other things that shows you things have shifted is the marine life out there. And so we're seeing more, you know, we're seeing more sharks in the shallow waters. Not that they're dangerous sharks because they're smaller. It's like a nursery out there. But we're seeing more, and they do seem to be getting bigger every day. And part of that may be because of drone technology, we're seeing more, but everybody seems to think there's an increase in that. And now what we're also seeing is we're seeing other animals that tend to be farther out in the Pacific or in deeper waters come in closer. And just yesterday I was reading about the tuna fish that are being caught nearby that normally people have to go down to Mexico to catch. They're catching them off the coast here of Southern California. Big tuna, huge tuna. And that indicates to me that things are changing that way too.
Right. As the situation warms, everything moves. The plant life up the hills or down the hills, depending on how its ecosystem, the animals who follow the plants up and down the hills, and that would make sense for the ocean as well. Jeff, we have not a exactly surprise visitor, but we're never sure with Germanicus. He's a busy fellow, and he's had a very busy week of apocalyptic remarks by the Imperator and by his opponents. So we'll invite Germanicus in. Germanicus, a very good day to you. Thank you for joining us. Jeff and I have been recounting the unhappy situation of Los Angeles, but you're here to help us understand the unhappy situation of the Roman Empire in the 21st century, which is the United States of America. I mentioned the headlines only in passing. I don't want to make everything into despair. But not only are the tariffs back from the Imperator, but so the Imperator is making more threats against Iran, massive airstrikes, that sort of thing. Oil has gone above $100 for the moment. I don't think it's been there since April, but it touched above 100. Now it's backed up a little bit. And we have a headline from Reuters this morning. I just mentioned Iran flew IRGC commanders' missile gear to Yemen's Houthis.
Yes.
The move suggests Tehran is seeking to strengthen the ability of its Houthi allies to threaten Red Sea shipping. And we know that Red Sea shipping is Saudi oil. And the Houthis are claiming they've hit two Saudi tankers. So, good morning to you, Germanicus. And by the way, things are looking worse. What have you got? Good day.
You mentioned Rome and Rome's proclivity to get into multi-front wars ultimately spelled its near downfall in the third century. It's never very good, no matter how big an empire you are, your actual military resources are finite, in fact, often extremely limited. And when Rome had wars on three fronts, as they did in the third century, they were close to going down for several decades. And we have wars on several fronts, and we're stoking them. And that seems to me to be foolish in the extreme. We have the tanker wars in the Red Sea and Persian Gulf and Arabian Sea. And the traffic isn't moving out of the Persian Gulf. You're getting between 8 and 12 ships passing every day instead of 120. The Houthi have openly declared now that they're going after Saudi shipping. And whether or not they strike the port of Yanbu, which is accounts for 5 million barrels every day being loaded up, that they can pretty much cut down the traffic. Traffic through the Bab el Mandab is still only 90% of what it was in 2023. And that means that decrements beyond that, down to 60% or less, are going to really hurt, especially because the cargoes that are not using the Bab el Mandab are the really big cargoes because they can't risk it. And that means that it's actually a lot higher than a 10% loss today. And tomorrow it may be 30, 40%. The tariffs are also interrupting the global supply chain in a big way. So you have all of this going on, and then add to that the issues with the Black Sea and the Ukrainians, which really means NATO and the U.S. striking Russian shipping. And it's ironical, Russian shipping, in spite of the hits, Russia is still making much more money now than it was even several months ago because of the price of oil. And so we taketh and then we giveth in the sense that they're not hurting in terms of revenue. Where they're hurting is the mood of the Russian people because they're short on gasoline. And the problem here is that, and the problem with Iran is really the U.S. problem, or the U.S. Imperial Court and all of its retainers. They believe that pressuring a country will lead to it surrendering or submitting. And the opposite is true. Russians are getting really angry about interruptions to their gas supply, and they're calling for escalation in the war to end the war. That's not a good sign. And Russians, to a man and a woman, feel that they're under existential attack. And some of them, of course, want the war to end. But there's a solid one-third, I was looking at polling, that wants to see an escalation to end the war. In other words, push things now and get it over with. And unfortunately, that's the way people in the administration, in the imperial court, are talking about Iran. We've got to finish the job. And we're beginning to strike at major civilian targets. I'm talking about hitting railroads and hitting power plants, desalination plants. We hit one of those in the south. This is extremely worrisome because it could lead to devastating effects if the Gulf states are hit in the same way. And then you add to this the drumbeat that one keeps hearing about a ground operation. And is that simply all the neocons agitating endlessly on Fox News and elsewhere, that we've got to finish the job? People like Mark Thiessen, for example, who are simply saying we can't allow this to go on, or Kellogg. These are really the tub-thumping war cry guys, the war hoopers. And if we were to engage in a ground operation, it would be an absolute disaster. So I don't know what's going on, and it's impossible to know what the atmosphere around Mr. Trump is. And I think the fact that it's not a situation of unanimity means that there's constant back and forth between small factions within the imperial court as to what the course of action should be. But above all, the main thing is, A, Mr. Trump has decided to hit Russia, and B, he's decided that we need regime change and that Iran must submit. So you get two now great powers, at least in terms of their ability to deal with us in combat, you put them into, if not an unconditional surrender situation, a situation in which they must prostrate themselves and give us what we want, as though it were some Iliadic-like ritual. And I think this is a real issue. And we're, as we've said time and again, the time is running out on oil supplies in the world. And again, this the collateral supplies of diesel and fertilizer. All this is the richest mix I've seen probably in my lifetime for a global disaster. And we just keep marching inch by inch toward that cliff face.
The Centurions are waving their hands. Centurion Bliss, you have a question.
Thank you. I have so many questions, none of them about the film The Odyssey, by the way. We've talked about what's happened in Ukraine and how we've been, working with their command and control to target the Russians. And there's been a lot of anger coming from Russia about that. But now it seems that Russia's doing and China are doing the same thing with us, with getting our places targeted in the Middle East. I mean, does this just play into what you've talked about before? It just moves us closer and closer to that precipice of, the worst thing in the world happening.
It does. And a lot of it's our doing. I mean, we forced the Chinese back in the 1990s or beginning in the 1990s to build their own GPS system. And that's a tale of its own. But we showed that as long as we had a monopoly on global positioning for navigation, we could essentially take away a ship's capability to navigate for itself. And so the Chinese built their own galaxy of satellites called Beidou. And the Beidou is now, for most of the world, far superior and more accurate than GPS. And the main thing is, it's jam-proof. So Iran, guess what, a couple of years ago, adopted Beidou. So suddenly, shock of shocks, they're hitting targets with a circular error probable in terms of what you want to hit of something like 5 meters, which is amazing. So we have in so many ways helped to create a situation that is a nightmare for us and a wonderful opportunity for our adversaries, and we have created our adversaries. We created the Russian adversary. We teased out the Iranian adversary to the point where it has to fight us. And we're now in the process of talking up China again. And this is terrible. You've got all of Eurasia now, with the exception of India and maybe Southeast Asia, because you have to include Kazakhstan and Mongolia as part of the Russian mix. So you have all of Eurasia united against us, and the Great Silk Road, the Belt and Road Initiative, at least the terrestrial part, is now becoming one of the great strategic bonuses of Chinese imperial diplomacy, because now goods can go directly from China to Iran, and of course the Russians can ship across the Caspian to Iran, and it's becoming a tighter and tighter network, a true superpower, and we're all along the rim of that, and we're weak along the rim. And I just read a story this morning; it just came out that various Pentagon officials are, I wouldn't call it a leak so much as an admission, that we can't create the high-end stockpiles of ordnance to continue to fight. So we're now using JDAMs and small-diameter bombs. The small-diameter bomb is a 250-pound dumb bomb, has some wings attached and a seeker And it has a relatively short range, but it's good enough in the absence of the more sophisticated air-to-ground missiles. And we're essentially running out. And the problem with using the cheaper, dumber munitions is that you have to get in fairly close. And you can bet that the equipment that Russia and China are shipping to Iran includes a lot of air defense capability. So we're in an impossible situation, and there is literally nothing we can do except to accept things. But we won't do that. I mean, the big problem today is that the U.S. will not, I say the U.S., the emperor, we're down to that. The emperor's system means that one man has to come to terms with reality. And so far, he's going in the opposite direction.
Germanicus, I'm reading about the flight of the German intellectuals from Hitler in 33 to 39. Mm-hmm. And we come to Paris, where they flee to, and not believing that they're not safe.
Right.
Not believing that the French government will give them up. They're there with the permission of the French government. And now we move to 39, when Britain and Germany are at war, September of 39. The intellectuals still won't move because they think that the British Empire has now weighed in and the war will be contained between Berlin and London and they'll work it out. And then we come to the events of 1940, the spring of 40, and the jump off of the German offensive. And there are the Abwehr taking over hotels in Paris, digging in for counterintelligence. And still people they're aware of the fact that this is a war, but it doesn't really touch them. The cities are not being bombed. Slowly, however, we know there's escalation underway. I mention all this because catastrophes, such as you're pointing to the possibility, don't come all of a sudden. It isn't on day one, you know, some kind of fantastic video game. It's escalation takes time, and it comes out of small wars, not big wars. And that's what we're witnessing. The U.S. is at a remove from Ukraine, and it's actively involved in Iran. Russia and China are at a remove from Iran, but we know they're active in their intelligence gathering and targeting. We believe they've been able to hit our bases because of targeting from space. Why not? We use it against the Russians, against the Ukrainians, so why wouldn't they use it against us? What I'm hearing from you this morning is that we're escalating in small steps, not with big weapons, but in small steps. So we're coming to a place where being directly at war with Moscow becomes more and more credible over time. Does that sound roughly where what you meant by the imperator? He's getting used to being at war with the principal.
Everyone is. All the leaders in Europe are getting used to it. And Russians are resigning themselves to the possibility of a world war. And Iran, of course, is in a totally existential situation. And what's important here is that the small steps you mentioned come from a multitude of directions. And they're very little ones that are hard to notice. For example, I just discovered that deaths in Ukraine, in the non-Russian occupied Ukraine, deaths are four times the number of births. So it's a little thing, and it's like a slow fuse. But then you have all of the European leaders now, especially British leaders, saying, well, we're going to have to reintroduce conscription because we're heading toward a world war. And the more they say things like that, and the more they take measures like building up their defense budget, the more they become committed to this outcome. So the doubling down isn't simply doubling down in the sense that, oh, we're not going to give in any sort of negotiation venue. It's that we're not going to negotiate at all, that this war is already heading toward a world war. But of course, to them, the world war seems far away and not possible, because the whole reality of what such a war would mean cannot be encompassed, since they have no experience since their grandfather's time. So they blithely march down that road. With the U.S., it's slightly different, and Mr. Trump, because like Mr. Biden, the emperor feels that the U.S. cannot be defeated because it's still the superpower, as Biden felt. We can provoke Mr. Putin because we're the greatest power on earth. We can do anything. And it hasn't sunk in. With all the evidence right in front of them, it hasn't sunk in. And yes, eventually you begin to think this is where we're heading, and we've got to suck it up and get ready to do it. And that, of course, is where you get the real tragedy.
Denial. At Centurion Bliss, I mentioned denial works in odd ways. You watch it in California. I watch it here on the East Coast. Denial is this. It's a fact. The Vichy government becomes two-thirds of France, and the Germans move into, this is the summer of 40, move into Paris. But the Vichy government, under the direction of the Germans, asks everybody who's a foreign national to register, and then they ask everybody to register on their basis of their tribe or their ethnicity or their race. 150,000 French Jews register to the Vichy government.
Yeah.
Not believing they will ever come to harm because they're under the power of the Vichy government. Germany's,
right.
The Nazis are in Paris when this happens.
Yeah, well.
And that's how powerful denial is. And well, I'm wondering if that's what we're witnessing right now. Denial in Europe, denial in Russia, denial here in the U.S.
Part of the denial stems from your obdurateness in being unwilling to accept a situation, or believing that if you keep at it a little longer, it'll get better and you'll win, or the situation will go away. And there's a third component, and that is ignorance. So all those people you mentioned were not in any sort of position to understand the dynamic of the war that was then unfolding. They could not understand why such a huge military alliance as Britain and France, which outnumbered the Germans 3-2, could be so easily defeated. And they couldn't understand that there were things going on in war that fundamentally changed the equation and put them in a far more perilous situation. And in the same way, Europeans cannot take on board their own deep weakness militarily and pusillanimity. And the U.S., as I just said, in terms of its leaders, can't take on board the fact that we're not only not a superpower, but we're not with the program when it comes to the new kind of seamless integration of unmanned vehicles and sensor nets in a way that has fundamentally changed the dynamics of war. And we haven't even begun to figure out how to either take advantage of that or how to neutralize. And the advantage now lies completely in the hands of Russians, Houthi, Iranians, and of course the Chinese are learning from their allies every single day.
Germanicus, what's the question for Londinium on Sunday that we invite our centurions to return and the audience to return as well? What question are you going to be addressing? Because you've come up with a variety of them this morning,
yeah.
all worthy questions, all of them, but one at a time.
Well, I don't want to repeat them. I'm going to call some of my trusted friends, you know, like Doug McGregor and others. I have people who are still inside. And I want to try and come to some kind of tentative synthesis of where all this is heading, because we need to pin down exactly what the prognosis is in terms of movement toward the worst scenario. And I think that needs to be done pretty quickly. And there are other people, Sal Marcagliano does What's Going On with Shipping is an invaluable research support. And all of these threads have to be somehow, however tentatively, woven together so that we can have a picture of what the movement of the next several months is. Because we've got to understand how close we are to the edge of disaster.
Germanicus is Michael Vlahos. Centurion Bliss is Jeff Bliss, Pacific Watch. I am Gaius on Sundays. I am the host on Fridays. We thank the Centurions for their attendance this morning. They're not unhappy entirely because there have been no gladiator games for some months now, and they're a little dull here. We have our own version of it, of gladiators that come to town. However, not tonight. We're going to Augustus's memorial. We'll sacrifice to him, and then we're going on to the theater, where it is my hope that one of those nights, karaoke night at the Roman Theater, where everybody can sing songs together. It's a festive occasion. This is very carefully to be continued, but what Germanicus touched on this morning is chilling, that we're in a catastrophe and we don't feel it. Not yet, anyway. There's no moment where you can point to yet. And right. The Roman Orchestra is ready. All right, boys and girls, I'm hitting the contract timing. No extra money today.
Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.